Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Field Pass, Season 6. We're still here, Dan and John. We may have Mikey at some point throughout the season. He said, you know, he's willing to get back on the microphone, especially given the expectations of this year, but we're happy to be back. It's about, what, the biggest Illinois football season in terms of expectations we've ever had?
It simply must be. I think when you couple everything together in terms of the returning production, plus the hype, plus the ranking, there's just no way that you can look at this team and not think that this is, at least in our lifetimes, one of the most hyped teams that we've ever seen.
I don't even know where we want to begin. Last year, Citrus Bowl champs, Shane Beamer taking them down, angriest little elf on the field.
Yeah, he was an angry elf. I mean, it's funny because I feel like we'll probably touch on this so much with how the similarities from 24 to 25 that we'll probably capture so much of our thoughts about 24 and how we are viewing 2025. But yeah, putting a bow on it, the fact that a 10-win season from Brett Bielema in his fourth season as head coach is just it's unbelievable that his ability to almost build in like a, I know that wasn't linear in the sense of the records because there was the blip in 2023, but the fact that it's just a constant churn and the feeling of the program's floor getting higher and higher and higher to the point where now we're in the college football playoff conversation. And this is not just like, oh, we're a dark horse or we're maybe going to sneak into the college football playoff. No, our preseason ranking is indicative of the fact that at the very least, the national media and everyone who's viewing college football thinks that Illinois has a chance to be in the college football playoff. Now, I'm not saying that we should expect to be in the college football playoff, but we should expect to be in the college football playoff discussion. And that's something where when you look at how 2024 ended, I mean, yes, you can look at metrics and see how, oh, well, they were an 8-win team, maybe a 9-win team that won 10 games. And it's like, sure, I get all that. But at the same time, that's what happens when you have a competent team that is coached by a guy like Brett Bielema. That is the stuff that we've been praying for since we've been watching it at Iowa, since we've been watching it when Fitz was at Northwestern. It's like these teams find a way to win football games just by the fact that they are better prepared and they have good coaching who's going to make sure that you don't make mistakes and the other team will eventually make mistakes because it's college football. And that's just inherent to the game. It's why we love it. So that's something where having that overperformance, quote unquote, in 2024 is something that I think we can, I don't say rely on because 5-1 in one score games is kind of rare, but it is still indicative of the program's health, especially under a guy like Brett Bielema.
I just want to say number 12, Illinois football, just repeatedly. Number 12, John.
It's incredible. Like the fact that, I just went on about it, but like, number 12, there are how many, Dan, can you please inform our listeners of how many teams make it to the college football playoff?
There's been a lot of discussion, but I still believe 12 do make it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what number are we to start the preseason rankings?
That's right, we're number 12.
Well, isn't that something? Isn't that something, guys? I just, like, that, once again.
If the season ended today,
yes, yeah,
exactly. We're in the playoff.
Everyone hold your horses. If the season ended, we're in the playoffs. Print the write the press clippings.
A group of five school getting in that's not in the top 12 and bumping us out, but don't rain on my parade. Number 12, Illinois. And all we've ever asked for is, you know, to raise the floor of this program. And like you said, not only has Brett Bielema done that, but he's expedited the process and he's turned us into a legitimate Big Ten contender, if you want to call us that, going into this season. So it's crazy. 16 starters are back this year. It's a lot of familiar faces, a few transfers here and there, but by and large, I think returning production has us top five in the country. You guys, if you jumped on the bandwagon last year, if you've been around for your entire life, you know this roster. It's the same guys led by Luke Altmaier, a new receiving core and new D linemen. And that's really it. It's everyone else is pretty much back.
Yeah. This is something that you and I talked pretty high level about before we got into it, just to kind of ground ourselves. And when you think about the position groups and, you know, the difference makers that you have within the program, I would say that probably, like, we talked about this last year. I think the thing that we harped on preseason, right tackle. Will they figure out right tackle? This team will only go as far as the right tackle goes. And that was something that pretty quickly proved to be not only correct, but something that was such a positive that we didn't see coming, that Melvin Priestley was going to come in and be one of the more dominant right tackles in the Big Ten. And someone that I know that everyone's glad came back and didn't take that whiff of NFL interest. And so that's something where, okay, O-line seems okay, but now what is the problem area for this year? Not in the sense of like, this is going to be an actual problem, but what could be the unforeseen issue that really tanks the season? And in the sense of, yeah, we're talking about number 12 right now. I think it's unquestionably the wide receiving core, not because there isn't talent there, but because you had two absolute studs there. I think anywhere else you look across the roster, it's either a position that's, I don't want to say unimportant because everyone needs to do their 111th, but you know, tight end hasn't historically been relied upon with the Brett Bielema team. So not having a whole lot of production from there projected, that's okay. The D-line consistently turns guys over. You know, when you went from Calvin Avery to T-Rod Edwards, everyone thought, well, that's a step down. And T-Rod did really well and had a sick interception in the preseason. Now it's okay. Yeah, you're turning it over to a bunch of guys from Wisconsin. I trust JMO with my life on these things. Even inside backer, that's Rosiak comes back from a broken leg. And you still have a bunch of talent, but not necessarily the proven commodities or guys coming off of injury. That's something where I'm not saying the middle of the field is obviously super important. So I'm not trying to say that your D-line and your inside backers can be poor, but if they're above replacement level, which I'm very confident Brett Bielema is going to have his team playing that, then you should be good. But wide receiver, you need those difference makers because Pat and Zakari bailed us out so much last year. Like we did our 10, our top 10 breakout plays. And it was one of those where it was either Zakari toe tapping or Pat Bryant scoring long touchdowns or bailing us out and getting us a win against Rutgers. It's like those guys, of course, we all know how great they are, but are we going to be able to replace that production either from one or two guys stepping up or in aggregate? Will that unit be dangerous enough to take care of business?
Yeah, like you said, Zakari and Pat, almost impossible to replace. We could have done our own top 10 of just their best plays, and it would have been probably better than some previous year top 10, you know, team plays.
In total.
But I guess jumping in on the receiving core, we have Hank Beatty back. Colin Dixon's back. There's a couple transfers. Hudson Clements, one of those, coming over from West Virginia. He had a great season last year. Justin Bowick is transferring in from Ball State. And then you got some other guys as well. You have a guy like Malik Elzey, who came in with a lot of expectations. Does he crack the rotation? You know, a guy like Ashton Hollins is still around. So there are some names. It's a lot, I think, to be figured out. It'll be probably several games before that rotation's established. Alex Kapka-Jones, another guy who's been around and, you know, has looked pretty good so far in the summer camp. But who do you kind of see emerging? Or do you think it's just, you know, a platoon all season long?
Yeah, I mean, I would love for the answer to be Malik Elzey because they need one of those bigger guys to be able to take care of either stretching the field or making the big physical plays like Pat would. Zakari was kind of he's physical as well, but he wasn't as, you know, consistently thrown to when you're going over the middle and needing a big physical receiver to make a play. I feel like that's going to end up being Hudson Clement then. He's, I think, a bit bigger than I realized when I was first watching him on tape. I thought he was kind of like maybe your classic slot receiver, but he's big enough that he should be able to play outside. And I think your best three is probably Beatty, Dixon, and Clement. Obviously, you can interchange a bunch of pieces there, whether you're looking for more speed or more, I don't want to say consistency, but if you think someone's going to give you more consistency, then I would love for Malik to be that guy that emerges and then Clement to kind of be a Swiss Army knife for a year. And, you know, when Beatty needs to go out, then he goes into the slot. Or honestly, the fact that Pat and Zakari were interchangeably used in the slot as much as they were last year, I have absolutely no qualms with Dixon or Beatty working inside, outside. They should be fairly interchangeable. So I think you still want that one big wide receiver. And now, to that end, maybe it's Cole Rusk because he's more of a receiving threat. Maybe it's one of the other tight ends who are transfers who can kind of be that big presence in the middle. I think when you're looking at it, though, you want a guy who's big and long and can stretch the field. So maybe it's Bullock, maybe it's ACJ, but I'm really hoping that it's LZ, because as much as people are expecting the breakout from Colin Dixon in terms of him ascending to that next level, they've seen the progress of from the red shirt to then just breaking out as a redshirt freshman to, okay, maybe he takes this next step as a redshirt sophomore. I mean, Malik Elzey is in the same class. So yes, he's had a bit more exposure in terms of playing his first 2 years, but that's something where you might be able to get an ascension out of him that is even exponentiated. So I'm hoping that it's him, but at the same time, I think I'm realistic enough to think that it's probably more Hudson Clement. So I don't know what your thoughts are on that. I know I kind of touch on everyone, but it's just going to be the enigma of all enigmas till probably like, I'd say week three or four,
yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, I just think with five returning offensive line, you know, your entire offensive line returning, having Luke Altmyer back, he's going to have plenty of time to throw the ball around. So it's going to be about guys that, who can get separation, and he'll find you. So, you know, I hope Malik Elzey, he's athletic as can be. Hudson Clement's got some wiggle to him. You know, I'm with you. I kind of think those two guys will be squarely in the rotation, at least, you know, a few weeks into the season. And then a guy like Hank Beatty, who's been in the system for a while, and Colin Dixon as well, who, you know, those guys were able to get open at times last year when we needed them. I mean, Hank Beatty in the Citrus Bowl had one of the most unbelievable catches. He also had a few sideline catches and big moments. So he might be the, you know, the clutch go-to guy when you need a first down late this season. But Colin Dixon, you know, as well, has kind of been waiting in the wings behind Pat Bryant, behind Zakari. Hopefully those guys taught him well, and maybe this is his opportunity to take a step forward.
Yeah, and I feel like maybe, I don't want to say lost in all of this, but something that maybe becomes a focus for this year and kind of the yin-yang is that the running backs get relied upon more in the prototypical Brett Bielema style of having three guys near, I don't want to say 1,000 yards, but maybe 750 or 600 with a couple of those guys going over 1,000. I wonder if that's how they go about maybe ameliorating the problem of not having a true 1-1 wide receiver. But luckily there's enough talent in that wide receiver room that you can at least threaten that defense. And so they can't just stack the box like a Wisconsin team of old or like in Iowa was for the past half decade plus, or, you know, even like Minnesota has been for the past couple of years. It's one of those where you could kind of get away with stacking the box against those teams because there wasn't as much of a threat to pass, say, for maybe a couple years. I think this year, because of the production and the confidence that the wide receiver unit has, you should be able to at least get some sense of respect from a defense. And that's when maybe they do just lean on their run game more. And to your point about the five returning offensive linemen, that should only help things be opened up and guys be more productive. And then you can just do anything you want from the play action standpoint. That's how you can get separation so easily from misdirection, even if guys aren't able to get themselves open. So maybe the run game is the lead dog this year, whereas the pass game was last year. So that is the one thing where I trust Barry Lenning to figure that out.
You hinted at kind of what I wanted to go to next, which is the run game. And you mentioned it, you know, we have the stable running backs. You have Caden Fagan, you have Aiden Loffrey, and you have Khalil Valentine back there. All three very capable guys. Is there a possibility that Barry Lunney looks at his talent and where it's, you know, dispersed? And like we mentioned, maybe there's more unknowns in the wide receiver room. And he says, hey, we have five returning offensive linemen. We have these great running backs. Maybe we do something a little bit different. Maybe we do some two running back sets and, you know, try to cater to that personnel. Or do you think kind of he sticks to what he's done and what he did last season and kind of runs a similar offense?
You know, I think it's going to be dependent upon, one, the pass blocking ability of these running backs, because as much as I would love to get two backs out on the field, if you're running like a shotgun with two backs, like you're just going to need, obviously, for them to be passing threats, which I think Caden Fagan has showed flashes of, and I trust Aiden Loffrey to be able to do that as well. And Khalil Valentine just has the pure athleticism that even if we haven't seen it, I trust that he can also make dangerous plays in the passing game. But I definitely remember a play last year where Khalil Valentine came in for an injured Josh McCray, I think, or maybe one of them was injured, and he immediately whiffed on a block and there was a fumble or a sack, and you just can't have that. So if you're going to have two running backs out there, they're going to need to have stepped up their game in pass pro. And as much as I would like to say that I am very confident in that, you got two guys who also haven't, you know, necessarily been the most healthy boys in terms of Aiden Loughery. He was consistent last year towards the end, but he had been battling a couple things when he first got to campus. Caden Fagan obviously undergoes a huge hip surgery. How is he going to battle back from that? He has a naturally physical running style that also is kind of upright. So, you know, he's going to be taking more of a pounding. These are things that I would love to be able to sit here and say, yeah, of course, like they can just run two running back sets and run that until the cows come home. But maybe they do something fun with Jordan Anderson. Maybe he's kind of like their fun up back and that's how they get, or even Tanner Arkin as like an H back. And they use one of the transfers who, cause both or the San Diego State kid or the San Diego kid and the Ball State kid are both like 6'6", 270. So you can put those at inline tight ends, put Tanner Arkin in the backfield, and maybe you have some fun there. But I don't know what you were about to say about Jordan Anderson, but I will let you roll with that.
That was going to be my next follow-up question to you was, maybe it's not two running backs, but maybe you have some interesting packages where Jordan Anderson, who's, you know, started in the running back rooms, now a tight end, is kind of in that hybrid mold, could maybe, you know, be moved around and used, you know, in pass protection as a blocker if needed, or, you know, potentially even run routes. So maybe that's a mix. I don't know that he's going to see too many snaps out there as kind of like this fourth string, you know, tight end, fullback, running back kind of hybrid guy, but I could see him getting in the mix. Like you said, Devin Stoffel, Christian Abney as well, two newer guys that we'll see. You know, I think they'll probably be used a little more in the blocking games, similar to kind of what we thought Henry Boyer might be. And, you know, Tanner Arkin, he'll be kind of the everyday, every down tight end. And then you got a guy like Cole Rusk who kind of split out, be more of that receiving tight end, more of maybe a Daniel Barker type of role out of him. So you got different pieces to play around with. It'll be interesting to see how Barry Lunny chooses to deploy them this season.
Well, I can't imagine there are many Illinois football previews that are going to do a couple of minutes on Jordan Anderson like we are, but I will say this. It feels like he's a guy, maybe not this year, so I guess we're getting out ahead of a take, but he kind of feels like the Isaac Darkangelo or the Ryan Needs of the world, where it's like, you just know that they're good culture program guys, and like Brett Bielema always gets the most out of those types of guys. And maybe it's just special teams for this year and a couple impact plays in the blocking game, or maybe a couple catches in the flat that turn into, like, I don't know, a 5 or 6 yard gain on 3rd and 2. And that's it. And then next year we say, okay, maybe this is the breakout of him, you know. But he feels like that kind of guy where you're just like, he's not a walk-on, obviously, like those two were, but it's kind of in that same mold of doesn't necessarily have the most natural fit in the scheme, but tries his hardest and then turns into something because that's how Brett Bielema rewards his players, and they, you know, end up paying dividends for the program.
And then going into the run game a little bit on the O-line, I thought toward the end of last season, you look at the Northwestern game and the South Carolina games, like it seemed like our offensive line, especially in the run game, run blocking seemed to improve throughout the year. There were times early in the season, I think about the Kansas game, where we struggled kind of to get the run game going, and we ended up relying a lot on Luke and Luke's arm. And even Luke himself, like there were times where he'd get out there, but, you know, I think he can potentially be a 400 or 500 rush yard guy, depending on whether or not Brett Bielema's okay with him being that. You know, he is the face of this team and this program for this season, and it's, do you want to allow him to, you know, utilize all of his skill sets, or are we going to be smart and tell him, hey, we don't want you getting out of the pocket too much unless it's really there, and when you are outside, we need you to get down or get out of bounds because we can't afford an injury, you know, at the quarterback position. But it felt like the run game really started to come on late, and I'm hoping they can carry that momentum into this season.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the continued meshing of the offensive line unit throughout the year was a good sign of progress. I know that, you know, I don't want to say there were misgivings about the interior of the offensive line, but I think there are some pretty clear limitations when you're talking about guys with either their pedigree or their measurables or just their development curve and where they're at, and hoping that, you know, the guys like Geske and Kurtz are finally hitting that pinnacle of, yes, these guys are much older, they're so much more experienced than the people they're going to be going up against, that they're going to have a down pat. And Brandon Henderson, you know, he really emerged last year, but that wasn't even a full year of starting for him. So maybe with that confidence in his back pocket, he could be able to go out there and move humans really easily. So that's like, and I think we're pretty confident in the tackles being able to take care of themselves. Maybe Melvin's definitely the better run blocker. I'm not expecting JC to be, you know, the biggest mauler, but at the same time, he's still just going to be a man amongst children at a certain point. And it's something where they should be able to enable the run game. It's not going to be Chase Brown levels of, you know, him bailing out some, I don't want to say poor offensive line play his final year in Champaign, but I mean, there were some holes there that Chase Brown just made out of thin air. And that might be something where almost the inverse has to happen, where you're trying to figure out who your bell cow running back is. And maybe you never figure it out for the season, but you still end up providing enough big play ability with the holes you're creating on the offensive line that it kind of just figures itself out. And to your point, I think that that allows you to have more confidence in using Luke in the run game, because if you're imposing your will on the defense and you're gashing a team for 3, 4, 7 yards a pop with your running backs, then they're naturally going to have to respect that more than just, okay, well, we can kind of crash it. Maybe they gash us for a little bit here with the running back, but we're still going to be able to commit a guy or two to Luke. And then it turns into, well, no, we got to sell it to stop the run. And then you get Luke running up the sideline for 15, 20 yards, and then also not taking hits. Cause I think that's the thing that everyone's concerned about. I feel like Luke takes hits pretty hard just from like watching last year's games and even thinking about his time when, you know, he got hurt and Paddock came in and all that. Like he's a big enough dude, but he's, you know, quarterbacks, they're made to throw the ball and stand back there. And that's kind of how their body composition works. And it's one of those where I'm not saying that he's not tough, because he definitely sticks his nose in it. And I'm grateful that he does. That kind of grit doesn't go unnoticed by the team, but you need him healthy for, yeah, hopefully, what is it, 16 games or something like that. So hopefully that run game plus that they get from the offensive line that enables the running backs then turns into Luke having a bit more space to not only get chunk plays, but also get his butt down.
Yeah, like you said, Luke has a unique way of making normal tackles look vicious.
Yes, that's a great way to put it.
There's been several times where it's like, man, he went down hard. Yes. And kind of ragdolled him a little bit, and he's not a small guy by any means. He's not a big quarterback, but he's got some meat on the bones, and he's a slippery runner. But sometimes when defenses get their paws on him, he goes down in a hurry. So got to keep him upright.
He's got to go to the Brandon Peters school of turtle diving. Yeah. Brandon would just kind of like, he'd dive and turn his head down and his back towards the defender. And hey, you're just not going to, I'm not saying that Brandon was soft. He was just doing the smart thing and getting his butt down. So that's, yeah, that's a beautiful way to put it. He makes the easy tackles look vicious. That's, put it on a quote card, folks.
I will say my number one concern about this team is Luke Altmyer and keeping him healthy. I feel like that's the one thing in my mind that could really derail things this season. So, you know, I'm okay with, you know, not running him maybe as much on quarterback design runs, just to ensure we're keeping him in a good, you know, bill of health, because I think that's, you know, Ethan Hampton as the backup quarterback transferred in from NIU. He's the man who took down the Irish in South Bend. And I think he's an okay backup, but everyone knows Luke. He's, you know, the returning starter, 3 years in this system. He knows the offense. He's been in the big moments. He's, you know, proven himself in the big moments. And that's my worry. You lose that guy and things could unravel.
Yeah, I think to your point, I mean, obviously any kind of the depth of the program is as good as it's ever been. It's still, for the expectations that I know all of us have, it can't really afford many huge injuries, not even to just like the big guys, but even to some of the more impact starters. And of course, like, you can never project out injuries, but to your point, if you can do anything proactively to make sure that Luke isn't put in harm's way, then you of course do that. And that's something where, yeah, maybe they don't run him as much unless they're really going for the jugular against, you know, a USC or an Ohio State, and, or, you know, you need a big play against, you know, the boogeyman that seems to be Purdue, no matter what. It's one of those where, yeah, you let him put his head down and run, and you have confidence that you've got you have a guy in the program who went into South Bend and beat, you know, the runner up to the 2024 season. Like that's no small feat that Ethan Hampton has that pelt on his wall. So I think that, you know, it's good that they identified that, but you obviously would love for him to be holding a clipboard and having a hat on for the entirety of the season.
Flipping to the other side of the ball, just like there's continuity with the starters on offense and, you know, the same offensive coordinator, Aaron Henry's back. You know, he's got plenty of continuity on his side of the ball as well, particularly in the back seven. But starting up front, a few new names, transfer from Florida State, Tamiwa Durajaye. But I think, you know, we should start with James Thompson and Kurt Neal, two guys who transferred over from Wisconsin. I think James Thompson kind of has lofty expectations. I know you're high on him. What do you like about James Thompson up front?
I mean, he is definitely, in my opinion, no disrespect to Dennis Briggs, who was more productive than I thought he was going to be. So grateful that he stayed healthy for the entire year. Just a great story to see out of that guy. I think James Thompson is the best defensive lineman that we've had since Johnny. I think he could challenge Keith. Now, Keith was hurt his final year and, you know, maybe didn't have the progression that we wanted to see before going to the league. But I think that he could have that type of effect. And, you know, it might be in a similar way that, yeah, I'm not saying he's going to be as good as Johnny, but the way that Johnny would command a double team or even triple teams or even on rundowns, and he would still, it wouldn't be an issue of effort. He would still go out there and blow a play up. And that's something where maybe James Thompson is felt more in the run game, but I'm just expecting him to go out there, be a grown man. You know, he's got long levers, good power, good speed. It's just, I'm incredibly excited to have a guy like that fall through. I don't really know how Wisconsin let him go. I guess that's like the only argument you can make is that a pretty poor Wisconsin team last year didn't have him come back, but maybe it was just, they thought it was best for both sides because he missed the entire year with a torn pec. But I think it's, you know, Dennis Briggs, I don't want to say on steroids because we don't want to incriminate our guy, James Thompson, but you know, he definitely has that upside of Dennis Briggs plus, and could be even challenging a guy like Keith in terms of his productivity and his impact on the game. So that's, I mean, I think the defensive line kind of goes as he goes. I trust JMO to get the most out of all those guys, like we already talked about, but I think you definitely need that kind of stalwart to be a guy that they lean on, especially since I don't know how much we'll talk about it, but I'm curious if their defensive line rotation change in terms of like last year, they would do the thing, or even for the past couple of years where for substitution purposes, they would kind of like they wouldn't have Johnny out there for third downs in obvious pass rush situations because they were going to get a breather and also chew clock because they'd do the thing where they'd wait for the last possible second to then get their subs in. So then the offense wouldn't be able to make any changes. I'm curious with how the conversation around that has changed, or not changed, but how it's happened over the past, it's called 6 to 9 months. If there is any kind of like limiting of rotation reps. So then you have James Thompson out on the field more and making more of an impact. And that could, I don't want to say be a net positive, but maybe if you're not taking him off as much as they have guys in the past, then it turns into a very, very positive thing.
Yeah. The only thing I'll add about James Thompson is I love him in the little, you know, Illini football videos they put out when they ask the players a question and they get their responses. He just seems like a good vibes, good locker room guy. And I've heard the rest of the team's been calling him Unk, just given how old he is.
And he's always got a bucket hat on. I respect a guy walking around with a bucket hat on. That's just like you said, good vibes.
True. I guess inside on the D-line still, besides the guys we mentioned, Kurt Neal, Tamiwa, James Thompson, you got some other guys as well back. There's Pat Farrell. Angelo McCollum could take a step forward this year. There's another new guy transferred in from Northern Iowa by the name of Carter Hewitt. And then you even have, you know, looking farther down the depth chart, guys like Gentle Hunt, Jeremiah Warren, Demetrius John, some other names that have been around now as well. It seems like, you know, despite there being some unprovenness to the starters, there seems still to be some decent depth there at that position.
Yeah, and I'm honestly, I think a guy like Jeremiah Warren is going to be exciting to watch how he progresses just because he seems physically to give them something that maybe they haven't had on the interior for a while. I mean, I know that T-Rod was a pretty physically imposing guy, and Calvin was just, you know, a massive human. But in terms of getting some length at that you know, nose, that one tech, that interior tackle position, that's something where I'm curious to see how Jeremiah Warren progresses over here, and if they give him some leash and some run. But that's, to your point, that's a lot of good names out there that you hope that someone, you know, makes their hay and they emerge over time. And like I've said ad nauseum, I trust JMO to identify that by the time that we're going to Bloomington, Indiana. But does it end up being, Carter Hewitt, just kind of like a random, not random late ad, but a guy that seemingly could make noise in terms of that transfer up, and hasn't, I feel like, really been talked about too much. And so maybe that's a guy who takes over for like the Wisconsin crew, as it were known.
Similar to the wide receiver room. I think that's, you know, those interior D linemen we'll learn about 3 to 4 weeks into the season and get a better idea of who we have and who emerges. But I guess the biggest position of strength, the outside linebacker room, it all starts with Gabe Akis. Everyone knows the name, you know, probably a first, maybe second or third rounder in the upcoming draft. It, you know, he's the face of the defense along with Xavier Scott, who we'll get to in a minute. But the other guys around him, Leon Lowry is here as well from Wisconsin. We have Alec Bryant, who has made quite an impact toward the end of last season, had some big time plays. Daniel Brown had some big plays. I think about the Citrus Bowl and, you know, big time play he made in that game. You got a guy like Joe Barna who's around. So a lot of names, a lot of guys who potentially, you know, would be starters on other teams that may not see as many snaps on this year's team. What do you think of that rotation?
I think the diversity of body types doesn't hurt at all, especially when you have a guy like Gabe who has proven that he can put his hand in the dirt. I mean, you could have a situation where on a rush down, or, you know, when you're just really looking to go, you have James Thompson and Gabe Akis flanking your defensive ends. And then I don't even know who emerges as your rush defensive lineman, but you could even still have length, like a guy like Carter Hewitt or Jeremiah Warren, or even Pat Farrell. Like, you put those guys on the interior and they have enough length to make things work, to bat down balls, to affect the pass game and get after the passer. And then you still have enough talent in your outside linebacker room to make that worth it, to make Gabe putting his hand down worth it. And maybe that is ultimately where his position is in the NFL. I know that he's trimmed down. I think he's trimmed probably like, what, 20 pounds. Yeah. So I think he's trying to go after the premier position, which is smart. You know, if he's a stand-up rusher, or at the very least, you know, kind of one of those lighter ends, those guys make more money. So it's smart, but he's still, you know, chiseled as all heck. So I'm not trying to say that he's lighter now, but maybe he adds a couple points of agility and quickness to his and bendability to his game, and he can get after the passer like we haven't really seen anyone of recent vintage. I feel like it's kind of either your classic big body types or your lankier, leanier, bendier types, and maybe he can be both. And that's a luxury that is unmistakably good to have. And something that, you know, it probably sets the tone for the rest of the defense in terms of them being able to do whatever they want. And that means so much. I mean, not to jump positions, but like, you have the continuity in the back end. You have that, which to the degree that we did in 2022 was such a huge part of the success of that season. But you not only have that, but then you have that paired with the ability to rush the passer up front. It can't be undersold how good it is to have a guy like Gabe Akis in your program.
Getting into the defensive back room a little bit, we talked about Gabe Akis, one of the stars. The other star of the defense, Xavier Scott, you know, he and Gabe collectively are kind of the face of this year's team on the defensive side of the ball. You have a lot of continuity there as well. Cornerbacks, Caleb Patterson, Torrey Cox, who both played pretty well last season. And then the safety room, Miles Scott. You have Matthew Bailey back. He's healthy by all accounts. And then a guy like Mac Rosetich, who should be in that rotation as well. What do you like about the defensive back room this year?
Yeah, in a similar way that I feel like right tackle was kind of the canary in the coal mine, or would have been the canary in the coal mine last year. I think CB2 is going to kind of be that for the defense. And when I say that, I mean, like, Xavier can play both inside and outside. I don't really know what his NFL position is, because he's long enough that he should play on the outside, and that's where the money is made. But maybe he's not quick enough, so he's more of a slot extraordinaire. Or maybe they turn him into a safety. Don't really know, don't really care. He'll get picked high because of his athleticism, but also his toughness. But you have him as kind of your known commodity. Caleb Patterson, he played pretty well, very well at times last year. If he makes that next step and he emerges as not only, you know, somewhat consistent, but just a consistently good corner over there, either opposite Xavier or taking over our team's number one when called upon, because Xavier needs to play in the slot, like, that is going to be invaluable. And that is going to dictate a lot of the defense. And maybe it's something where you have guys step up, you have a Juice Clark step up, you have a Torrey Cox continue to make huge plays. But I think that Caleb Patterson is kind of like the, he is going to be the marker of how good this defense truly can be. If this is like another special type defense like we had in 2022, I think you can look to a guy like him in terms of how well he plays over the balance of the season. And that's kind of the indicator of, oh yeah, like, it was special because you had guys like Xavier and Gabe, but you had guys like Caleb Patterson rise to levels that we didn't think. Like, you know, we were talking on a scale of 1 to 10, and maybe you think his ceiling is maybe a 7.5 or an 8. If he plays at like an 8.5 or 9 out of 10 for the balance of the season, that's something that, you know, is going to take them to probably easily a double digit season. If, you know, you get your production out of X and Gabe that you think you're going to get.
And maybe he doesn't, and maybe, you know, a Jaheim Clark emerges, or you know, Tanner Heckel, someone along those lines who is ready to make that leap does. But it's a good problem to have if, you know, you have this depth chart of guys who are capable of kind of making that leap and jumping into the rotation.
Oh, yeah. I think the point still stands, yeah, of like it being CB2 regardless. I think obviously Caleb's that guy right now. But to your point, that's it's a beautiful point. If someone surpasses him because, you know, they're playing so well, and that CB2 becomes a Juice Clark, or it becomes Torrey Cox, or it becomes Tanner Heckel, I won't complain about that one bit. I think that that's, you know, when you're thinking about teams throwing it all over you and trying to beat you, that's the corners, I'm not going to say are suspect, but because Xavier isn't quite in that spoon category of like, you put him on the side or you put him on your best guy and he shuts him down, no problem. Not saying he can't necessarily become that this year, but I don't think that's the expectation as we're looking at the season. He's more of kind of your Swiss Army knife through the corner / nickel room, and really is a defensive playmaker in the way that he can find the ball and affect the play on any given down. But if you have that emergence from your outside corners, it's just going to make things all that easier. I mean, that's not, you know, earth-shatteringly breaking analysis, but at the same point, like, they definitely have that progression possible there. And I think the play of the safeties is going to be so fascinating because, I mean, I love Mac Rosetich. It's a shame that, like, I don't want to say a shame, but guys like him and Joe Barna, I'm really hopeful that they pass some kind of legislation where, or not legislation, but the NCAA passes a rule where you can play 5 years in 5 years. I understand the value of Miles Scott. I'm not trying to downplay the fact that he's a leader and that he's older. And sometimes those guys, their bodies just develop enough that, you know, they're bigger, faster, stronger than the guys they're going up against. With how Mac played towards the end of last year and the confidence that he had and the production he had, I'd be hard pressed to think that, you know, him and Matt Bailey shouldn't be getting the majority of the snaps as a pairing. But I think that type of thing will play itself out week 6 or 7, or game 6 or 7, I should say, hopefully. I don't know. That's kind of how I feel about the defensive backfield. I don't know if you have any deviations on that safety room or what you're kind of looking at when you're thinking about the back five.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I think the guys who are just on the outside looking at the rotation will certainly be factors in the special teams department. You know, one tidbit I guess I'll add about Tanner Heckel, from what we've heard, they did some combine testing of all the players, and I think he graded out number one on the entire team when it comes to his raw athleticism score. So he's somebody I think could crack the rotation, and they, from what I've been told, want to get him on the field at some point. So I guess that's the one guy I'd say, you know, to look out for.
Mm-hmm. That's a guy that, you know, should be able to make plays sooner rather than later. And hopefully, at, you know, maybe he can relieve X at nickel and play that down after down. And then you've got, you know, X and whoever is CB2 on the outside taking care of business. And then your defense is just that much stronger.
All right, John, it's not a field pass episode if we don't talk about special teams. I don't know, what are we like 40 minutes in here and we haven't even mentioned anything about special teams.
A crime against humanity. I can't believe that this is going. We should have led with this. We were talking about Jordan Anderson and we should have been talking about David Alonso. What are we doing here?
Yeah. I mean, we have a new punter. That's fun. Although I will say he does come from a place we don't like very much, and that's West Lafayette. And, you know, if we just judge strictly based off our experience against Purdue, he probably didn't get too many punts last year, right? Like, all they do is score points, 49 of them against us. So that guy must not have gotten much practice, right? Purdue must have been great team.
He might actually be bad. Yeah, because Purdue was so good that there was no way that they were punting a bunch and playing poor football, because that wouldn't happen again with a Ryan Walters program at all. No. They're too busy winning big recruitments for Luke Williams and posting it on social media.
Offensive coordinator Ryan Walters too, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he's such a good football mind. I honestly, like, he was kind of a putt about things, and I don't know if I'm necessarily rooting for him at Washington, but it will be cool to see him back in just like the defensive coordinator role. So I guess Washington team to look out for, and if we're doing a mini Big Ten preview. But yeah, I mean, continuing with the international punters is always fun times. It always makes for a good meme on the Twitter streets.
Yeah, what I always say about punters is hopefully we don't find out if our guy's a good punter or not, because we don't need to use him very much. But you know, I think by all accounts he's had, you know, he's impressed the staff. His hang time on his punts is solid, and I think is a decent replacement for Hugh. Like I said, hopefully we don't need him, as long as he can learn that, you know, south wind, from the South Farms wind, figure out how to do his best Blake Hayes impression and snap an oar over his knee. Like, that's all I really care about.
Exactly. Also, I guess to not get too technical, but like holding, make sure that he's a good holder. Cause there were a couple times last year where we had some potentially suspect snaps taken care of because of good holds. And so I guess that's one thing to, if you're looking for the keys of the Western Illinois game, how good are the holds during field goals? That's a tidbit for you folks right there that you're not going to find anywhere else.
I always am biased, but like my thought has always been that it should be the backup quarterback or some sort of like fifth string wide receiver, just because typically your punter or your kicker are not the most athletic person. And like, at least a quarterback, their entire career they've spent, if they've been a shotgun quarterback, like receiving snaps to them. And I've always thought, I mean, we've seen plenty of punters that are holders as well, but like, I just, for some reason, don't trust punters when it comes to holding.
I get for the NFL because they, like, all they do is for practice is spend time with each other. And that's all, like, their job is literally just to play football. And right. Usually punters are good enough athletes in the NFL. Now in college, you can kind of get away with a guy who, you know, has good technique and maybe he only shanks a couple here or there, but hasn't quite selected out to being the best athlete. Maybe he's just a good kicker of a football from a drop kick, essentially. But yeah, I kind of agree, because yeah, also your backup quarterback in college, at least, is still probably like one of the better athletes on the field when you're in a field goal position. So it's like, if something does go wrong, or if you want to have
plays,
some trickery, exactly, then it's much more easily facilitated with a backup quarterback. But I guess even in college, like, it's still just specialists spending a bunch of time together and them, you know, getting to get their timing down and knowing exactly where the ball wants to be and how you want to hold it and turn it. It's like, okay, but I also trust Ethan Hampton to do that if necessary.
Yeah, I get that quarterbacks have a lot on their plate. So to ask them to just add one more thing where it's like, hey, you know, aside from all the practicing and learning the playbook you need to do, you also need to learn how to catch these snaps and turn them the right way and hold them. So I get it, but I don't know. I just never thought the punters are the most athletic guy. It's not the guy I trust catching balls, especially in the cold and the wind. So I don't know. We'll see if Keelan Cremins is the holder or not, but we do have David Alonso back. Big solid leg on him. I know he made 17 of 20 last year. his three misses. One was a block and the other two were outside 50 yards. So we ended up, I think Ethan Molchewski hit a 59 yarder last year, set the program record. We kind of had him do some of the longer, you know, more distance kicks, but I think David Alano is capable. It sounds like, you know, I heard he made a 60 plus yarder in practice the other day. So I think he's going to be the guy in pretty much every scenario, but I feel confident having a guy like that back.
And how can you forget a guy like Lane Hansen going out there throwing only elite lead blocks on fake punts? I mean, that guy out in the open field, seeing him pay homage to the elite Hansen athleticism in Illinois program history. When you can get a guy like that back, you love to see it.
Oh, yeah. 10 years of a Hansen in the Illini football program. We had, you know, reminiscing back to early field pass days, we had Jake Hansen, who just made the Texans roster. A lot of projections did not have him making the roster. He did make the roster, so congratulations to him. But
never forget when he announced that he was coming back on the pod.
That's right. Heard some good stories from Jake over the years and some insights into Brett Bielema and how good of a coach he was when it came to recruiting him to come back to the university after he got hurt going through the combine prep the first time around. So good to have, like you said, another Hansen, you know, another year of a Hansen on the team. I think I don't think there's any sort of petitions we can have to continue on the legacy, but you know, maybe Brandon Hansen changes his family tree or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just I guess they were the original. Brett Bielema always loved brothers wherever he coached college ball, but I guess they were the original set at his time in Illinois, even though they were inherited and not necessarily sought after. But when you talk about great brother duos in Illini football history, or great brother sets, I should say, because I'm sure there'll be some that have more than two. You got to put the Hansons in there just based off their consistency and them leading to an upward trend in the program.
Everybody loves multiple minutes of long snapper talk and multiple minutes of fourth string tight end Jordan Anderson talk as well. So you came to the right place.
This is why they pay us.
If you're still here,
lots of money to do this.
If you're still listening, we thank you. And we're also sorry. Punt returner, kick returner. I think we know punt returner. I'm trying to talk it into existence. I discovered 3 or 4 months ago that Illinois has the longest active drought without a kick return or a punt return touchdown. It's been 2013. V'Angelo Bentley was our last. So my hope is that I single-handedly will us to a touchdown. It doesn't matter who returns it for Illinois. The credit will certainly go to the field pass when we have a return touchdown.
It will certainly touchdown. Go to Dan. Certainly go to you, and solely you.
And I think Hank Beatty is the guy to do it. He was fourth in the country last year in punt return yards, which was actually kind of a surprise to me when I discovered that. But he had the big one against Rutgers. 59 yards, got it back inside the 10. He had a few other ones, and like, you know, some of the ones that were in his highlight reel that I put together were, you know, on paper 12 yard return doesn't look like anything, but he was making something out of nothing several times, and I think he's got that shiftiness to him. I get a little nervous when he tries to catch the ball over his overhand. He did that a few times rather than just securing it, you know, hands underneath the ball, but He's been able to make plays when he gets the ball in his hand, so I think he's definitely going to be the guy they go back to.
I can't remember which bear it was I was talking about blocking for Devin Hester, and I'm not about to make the Hank Beatty-Devin Hester comparison in terms of their athleticism. I will say, though, that the anecdote that it might have been like Kyle Long or something like that, like a guy who heard it through the grapevine, but not that it really matters. But essentially, when you know that you have a guy like that back there, it makes blocking not only much more fun, but you go out there with like just an extra bit of juice. No matter how much guys will say that they're putting 110% into each play, there are some plays that just naturally you kind of, I don't want to say take off, but mentally you might not be as clued in. When you have a guy like Hank Beatty back there who, like you just said, was top five in return yards and didn't even have every single game start as a punt returner because Matt Krusevich was given the opportunity for the first couple contests. And so that's where, like, knowing that he's going to be back there, most likely, and that he has the ability to game change the way that he does, maybe you do get a couple more blocks against that Rutgers team and you seal the edge inside the 30, and then he doesn't get hawked from, you know, some up back who you know, happen to take a good angle. Like maybe that happens because these guys are blocking just that little bit more, that 5 to 10% more, that then they know that it's going to break at any given point. So they can't quit on the play. So then it leads to even more lanes being open. And then you get that eventual touchdown, like you were talking about, that you are going to get credit for.
I certainly will take credit for it. I guess on the kick return front, one of the things I want to ask you, you know, Robbie Disher may have different philosophies, but if the ball is kicked to you, you're receiving it right at the goal line. Are you, you know, fair catching it, taking the touchback, or do you think that's, where's your line as to when you decide to return a ball versus not?
You know, I think it's set up well for them to be returnable this year just because of the depth that you have in front of you in terms of the guys blocking. I think in years past, or with just prior Illini rosters, you didn't have enough depth in the you know, the third and fourth tight ends, or your fifth and sixth string outside backers, or even, you know, your third and fourth string inside backers. Like those are the guys who are making up that those return units, especially on kickoff and kickoff return. I probably trust them enough, especially with the athletes that they'll likely have back there. Now, I don't know who it'll be, but if you have a guy like Khalil Valentine, who is, you know, as shifty as all get, if he can break one open, then I think I'd take that chance more times than not in terms of him taking it out from the goal line. But I also know Brett Bielema loves the field position game, and that if it makes more sense to just fair catch it every single time, I'm also okay with that. I just think it's one of those where it probably is indicative of the state of the program that I have. I'm not going to, like, you know, unless they're consistently only returning to the 15, 17 yard line, then I'll probably start stamping my feet. But like, if it's one of those where they're consistently getting around the 20 plus, like, then I think that it's worth kind of taking those bites at the apple, because you might eventually get one that either is at the 30 or the 35, or hell, you break one that goes past midfield and then you're really looking good. So I think with the way things look right now, I say take it out, but I'm pretty agnostic if I'm being quite honest.
Yeah. And to your point, maybe it's more about the opponent when you're playing Western Illinois and you're playing Western Michigan. Like, hey, we have the better dudes even on special teams. There's a significant talent gap there where we think we can kind of bully them and scheme something up to get better starting field position. But yeah, it's interesting. And I think it's just a matter of time before the NFL game, the way they've been tinkering with the kickoff and the landing zones and trying to make it a little bit safer, knowing the focus on player safety and how everything kind of revolves around that. This honestly could be the last year for all we know where, you know, the traditional college kickoff or football kickoff that you become accustomed to is no longer. So we'll see, but I'm curious who's back there. We'll find out tomorrow night on Peacock when we get that opening kickoff, if it's Khalil Valentine, if Hank Beatty's back there, if it's somebody else, you know, Tanner Heckel, potentially Mac Rosetich, who started as a punt returner, had a couple muffs and ended up getting Wally pipped by Hank Beatty. So we'll see.
I think you also make a great point on the opponent side. Not that, you know, I need to rehash it fully, but like to your point, if you're playing Ohio State, that their backups to the backups are 4 and 5 stars, then like, yeah, you're probably not going to be as aggressive returning kicks, and you just take the touchback and you play the field position game against them. That might be, yeah, something where you're less aggressive there, but it's a great point that maybe we see it happen a bit more early in the season, and maybe that builds enough confidence that you feel like you can get away with it against the USC's or the Ohio States that are loaded with athletes that are on their kick coverage units. But just something to look out for.
Yeah, Robbie Disher, when he was at Tulane, did have some really good special teams numbers and production numbers. So I trust him now that he's had a few years to kind of build out what he wants. I think this is the year we get the return touchdown at least once.
Cue the monkey off the back gif.
All right, shifting gears to everyone's favorite part of the preview. I think the season predictions. Going into the schedule breakdown, you know, where do you see wins? Where do you see losses? I guess we'll start. Maybe we kind of break it down high level, running through the schedule, and then, you know, we can both give our record predictions here at the end. But it all starts tomorrow, Western Illinois. Do you foresee I guess, John, should we just call this the John and Dan's annual eat your hat memorial game? If Western Illinois beats us, we will drive to Champaign, sneak onto the field, midfield, live record ourselves eating a hat, fork and knife at midfield.
We've long had this tradition on the podcast, and I'm glad you brought it up because, yeah, I think that going week one, it's a little risky. You know, you never know how Western's going to look. They might have made some big adjustments. They might catch us sleeping, but I agree that that's probably the eat our hat game of the century of the year.
All right, virtual handshake here. You heard it here first. Western Illinois upsets Illinois as a 45-point underdog. John and I will eat our hats midfield at Memorial Stadium. Live for all of you viewers to tune into, but no, Western Illinois, I think they played Indiana last year, lost 77-3 in one of the opening games. The question's not, you know, if, it's by how much will Illinois win this game. And I don't know, I don't see there being much drama in this one at all.
Agreed. I think, yeah, it's a good tune-up because going to Durham is going to be an interesting one. And, you know, Duke is playing today, so they have an extra day of prep. It's good that you at least have the Friday kick for Western so that you can, you know, try and recoup some kind of preparatory disadvantage that Duke has given us. But I think it's the perfect tune-up. You look at Duke and that's kind of like not the ultimate litmus test for the year, but that's going to be something that, you know, you at least, I think, as we sit here, and I'm not trying to hop all around the schedule, but I think we can also, you know, Western Michigan is one that we should also be favored pretty heavily in. But if we're thinking about Duke and Indiana, at a minimum, you got to split those two. Like, obviously, you're going to be trying to, but you're going to be away for both of them. So I'm not trying to say that, you know, the expectation should be that we go 2-0. But I think the expectation is that you should split those because of the fact that those are two good early season tests. And you have, you know, one of the best quarterbacks in the Big Ten. You have all this returning production that should benefit you that early in the season, even if you are going away. That's something I feel like where Brett Bielema can thrive in that environment. But yeah, that's kind of going to be for your first segment of four games. It's kind of like you got to be 3-1 somehow, some way for the season to stay on track.
Yeah, those Duke and Indiana games, like you mentioned, those are kind of the coin toss games. It's, you know, if you can go steal one on the road, potentially even two, I think we'll know a lot about this team after four games. We'll know whether or not they are a legitimate college football playoff contender this year, if they're just a, you know, just a, another good team that, you know, should go to a decent bowl game.
I mean, honestly, you steal both of those, and I know USC, it's the brand name, so, and maybe they start hot enough that you get to, I know everyone wants to talk about Ohio State. No, if we're 6-0 and, you know, playing Ohio State, then it could be a top five matchup and we finally get game day. I can see a scenario where, yeah, if you find a way to win it versus both Duke and Indiana, then you potentially have game day circling you and USC as a place to come visit. So that's one of those where, you know, homecoming will be bumping regardless. But yeah, you at a minimum need to be 3-1 going into that game. But yeah, 4-0, and we're really, really cooking with gas, especially for a USC team that's going to have to be making probably one of their first significant trips across the United States in the season. They're trying to figure out a bunch, and that will be, as much as we're talking about Duke and IU being litmus tests, like that one is going to be, okay, how is this going to crescendo throughout the year? Or are we going to have to dig ourselves out of a huge hole, you know, with two losses or three losses through five games, and, you know, you're starting to really reel as a program.
And I guess just taking one step back, I don't want to go too far into the weeds, but when I think about the Duke and Indiana games early in the season, as a team with a lot of continuity and a lot of returning production, I feel better about those games coming much earlier in the schedule than later on. You know, I'd rather play them early when I feel like we're ready to jump out of the gates quick and, you know, pick up from where we left off last season while these other teams are still figuring out their identities and, you know, working new players into the mix. So I like, it's favorable to me that Duke and Indiana come early, and, you know, same train of thought when it comes to USC, who's picked, you know, by odds makers as a better chance to win the Big Ten than us. So they'll be a test as well. And then you go to West Lafayette, a team that's, you know, hitting the reset button, certainly should be favorites in that game. And, you know, hopefully I feel like Purdue always plays us close, regardless of what the situation is. When the big drum and the little cannon come out, you know, we're in for a battle.
Just got to win by one. I also like your point on the Duke and Indiana, and this even applies to USC and Ohio State in terms of those, like, you know, your big first four marquee games. The quarterback continuity with the play caller is going to be so massive. Because, yeah, like, of course, you have Duke and Indiana spending a bunch of money to go get some talented dudes or perceived talented dudes. I think I saw as we're recording this that Indiana's quarterback is projected to be the number one overall pick by, like, CBS Sports or something like that. And, of course, it's way too early to put much stock into a mock draft. But, like, yeah, of course, they're projecting for a good season for Indiana if you have the number one overall pick. However, like, that's still a system that needs to be melded over the course of the season. And yeah, maybe you say by game four, they're going to have enough continuity to go up against the Illini. But like, Duke has a high price guy, Indiana high price guy, USC seems to, they have continuity, but it always seems to kind of be in flux, and it's not quite the guy that Lincoln's always had in his tenure at both Oklahoma and with Caleb at USC. So it's like, even Julian saying at Ohio State, will he be the starting quarterback by the time they come to town? It's like, the beauty of having Luke Altmyer and what you were talking about in terms of his health, it's so imperative, because if you have the better quarterback in college, that's just such a leg up in the chess game that even the continuity piece is going to boost how I perceive Luke in these matchups. And yes, I know that they're playing the defenses and not playing the quarterbacks, but just the way that shakes out, got to feel great having Luke third year in a system, you know, playing with a lot of confidence at the end of last year. And you know, I think that he might be the best quarterback on the field for all four of those games, even the IU one.
Yeah.
Like, that's just something where that gives you such a leg up when you're either playing on the road for your first two, like, kind of big tests, or you're, you know, hosting USC and Ohio State, two blue blood programs. And, you know, you have the quarterback advantage, that helps a lot. So that's I know that I'm kind of jumping around as well, but I think as we're holistically looking at the schedule, that's kind of like something to keep in the back of your mind when you're thinking about these, when you're thinking about the you know, the programs and the helmets and the jerseys, and you're not thinking about the names on the jerseys. Like, yeah, of course it seems a bit scary when you've got USC and Ohio State, because historically we're not in the same stratosphere as them, but having a guy like Luke Altmyer changes so much.
The one thing I don't love about the way the schedule sets up is the first bye does not come until after the Ohio State game. So we're going to play seven games before we get a chance to reset. More than half the season will be gone. And, you know, then we'll have that second bye after the
only two games.
Ninth game. Yeah. So two games after that, but you got to be ready to go, because 7 weeks in a row where you don't get a break, you don't get to hit a pause button to reset or figure anything out. So That's the one thing I don't love about the way the schedule sets up. I don't mind the way we have, you know, kind of a gimme game before we play our first test, and then kind of another tune-up game before we get into the conference schedule. But it is tough. You know, in years past, we've had, you know, or Brett's maneuvered the schedule in ways to give us those breaks to kind of figure things out. And we're just going to have to be ready to go this year.
Luckily, with that, it kind of, as much as the front half of the schedule doesn't necessarily break super favorably, although I do think that, you know, we can find the favorability within each matchup, those buys, you know, they kind of bracket things well in terms of, okay, you play Ohio State, whatever happens, happens. You have your bye week, and before a travel spot out to Washington is going to be huge in terms of, you know, going to face a program that, you know, we need to avenge what our first 2 years there at school, where we went to Soldier Field and got shellacked by the Huskies. So that could be something where, yeah, going out to Washington is going to be buffered by the rest spot with the bye week, and Rutgers coming to Champaign will be huge. Like, not that you can't really ever chalk up a win in conference play anymore, I feel like, just because of the fact that NIL is perforated throughout all of the Big Ten schools. I think, you know, Purdue, like you said, they're just going to give us a test because it's Purdue, but they're probably the only one who's got such huge roster turnover that it's going to be almost unmanageable for them to have like a decent season. But everyone else, you can talk yourself into them being, you know, a surprise either with the coaching or just the talent. So that's like the bracket of the byes having at Washington and then going, or not going to Rutgers, but then hosting Rutgers. I think that sets up well for, okay, we're getting back on track. No matter what happened the first 7 weeks, that's just a great, like, okay, we're hitting the reset. We're getting these two games. We got to, you know, go out there and perform. But I think that will play well to Bielema's strengths.
Yeah, for as much as, you know, we're going to be tested kind of early on, I do love, as it stands today, before we, you know, see these teams in action, the way the back half of that schedule sets up from Purdue and Ohio State onward. It's at Washington, like you said. Then we're home back-to-back games, Rutgers and Maryland, two games that, you know, will likely be favored in those. And then at Wisconsin, you know, hopefully by that time, Wisconsin is beaten down. Luke Fickell's beaten down a little bit. And, you know, we've owned Wisconsin as of late. So hopefully that trend continues. And then you get to play Northwestern in Champaign this year to close out the season. So if we can get through that first half of the schedule in pretty good shape, I really like the way it sets up to go on a run down the stretch and, you know, bring some momentum into the postseason.
Totally. As much as we might belabor the points about USC and Ohio State or even the travel and the bye weeks, getting Maryland and Wisconsin where you are getting them, I think, is so favorable, because I'm not saying both coaches are going to be fired, but it could be something where there's already hot seat talk for both Loxley and Fickell. Now, Fickell, I think, probably gets a pass, but you still might have a demoralized Wisconsin team if they're, you know, the gauntlet of the schedule that they're having to play, if they've already racked up seven losses by the time that the Illini are visiting them in Madison. Like, that's something where you might be able to put a stake through Fickell's tenure, and maybe they do end up firing him in a similar way that they did with Crist after we went into Camp Randall and beat them. So that's where I think that breaks super favorably for the Maryland and Wisconsin games being kind of towards the back end, where those programs might not have quit entirely, but might have quit on the season. And so that's something where it probably breaks very well. And then you get Northwestern at home, which I like David Braun as a coach, but I think that I'm very confident that Bielema, with getting his horses, is going to be able to outclass him more times than not.
Yeah, and in the back half, like you said, those later bye weeks can hopefully prevent us from one of those kind of letdown games like the Minnesota game last year, where, you know, we were the home team and kind of expected to win that game, and we just kind of showed up and had a bit of a dud there. So, you know, being able to reset after Rutgers to have Maryland come in, then, you know, hopefully you're ready to play there and don't have any of those letdown games this season. But given kind of the schedule and what we've talked through here, what's your record prediction and who do you have us playing in the Big Ten championship and beyond?
I'm going to have to go with 9-3 just because I think it probably follows a similar format in terms of how things kind of broke last year. I think we end up splitting that IU-Duke point of the schedule. And I think you get USC at home. And I think you give Ohio State a good run. But when you have arguably the two best players in college football on one team, on either side of the ball, it's going to be very hard to stack up against that and overcome that. It is any given Saturday. But I just don't foresee that being a W. And then, you know, as favorably as I talked about Rutgers and Maryland and Wisconsin, Rutgers might be looking for some revenge with Schiano, and he's a good rah-rah guy. Even Washington, Ryan Walters is going to scare me. So there, I just have a feeling there will be a loss in like the Washington Rutgers tranche. And if not, maybe you lay an egg like you were just talking about Minnesota last year. You go in and, you know, your favorite against Maryland, and then shades of, what was that, 2021 all over again, where we were at the Colonnades Club and just getting dinked on by Talia Tagovailoa. So that's like, okay. I just think that you get to that three losses mark more times than not. I don't necessarily foresee a fourth, just because the program's health, I think, is so good. And this is like the ultimate desire that we've had, is where I can materialize a fourth loss, but I'm not really feeling it. So I'm going to have to stick with 9-3 as the prediction. And then it kind of turns into, how does the SEC look again? And how do we fall in the Big Ten? Because right now we're perceived as the fourth best team by, you know, the polls. But are we going to be in that 5-6 range? Or is it going to be another year where some of those teams struggle, like a Michigan or a Minnesota or a Wisconsin or an Iowa? And then we're positioning ourselves to be that, you know, potentially fourth or fifth team. And then you're in the playoff conversation for sure. So I'm very curious to see kind of how things break. But I think 9-3, of course, is a successful season. I don't think anyone would count that out, but I just hope it isn't something where we're, you know, sitting there thinking, I can't believe that, you know, we gave it up to Rutgers after, you know, going to Seattle and beating Washington and knowing that we had a bye week and only two losses and we could finish this out strong, and then you lay an egg to Rutgers. I think that's just going to be, it's going to be similar, akin to Minnesota last year, where, you know, you play everything right and you lose the games you're supposed to lose, and then you have that one dud. But I just, as much as I know Brett Bielema is going to have his team's ready to go, I think it's still college football, and that's just bound to happen.
Before I give you my prediction, what would be a disappointing record for you this year? Be honest.
I'm going to say 6-6, only because with how things have coalesced, well, it's all relative, of course. Like, we've built a program. We've succeeded. We've done the thing that we wanted to do, where the program's floor is high enough that the expectation should be 7 wins this year. And we're capitalizing on a good schedule with an experienced core. And that's something that, you know, is unbelievable. People might say that you're becoming like a glorified Wisconsin or maybe a glorified Iowa, and that you can't reach that next tranche and that you aren't going to get to that next tier, and that the sleeping giant is just going to be, oh yeah, like maybe we'll get some good recruits 1 year. However, I would still say that 7-5 is successful in the context of Brett Bielema's tenure, just because he's put this together so quickly, all things considered, with not a huge amount of talent. He's recruiting even better and better year over year. He's been able to identify quarterbacks, whether it's a stopgap year with Tommy DeVito, finding a competent backup in John Paddock, finding a longer-term solution in Luke Altmaier. Obviously, recruiting is doing well in terms of some of the bodies that he's bringing in, but being able to identify a transfer like an Ethan Hampton who might be able to compete next year, or anyone else who's out there who has a higher ceiling/floor, like that's something where there should be plenty of excitement around a 7-5 season, because you know that these things are, like, the development of the program is still on a great trajectory. This isn't, you know, we're building to this one thing and then it's just going to all fall apart. And maybe 5-7 or 6-6 seems to indicate, okay, this thing was maybe, you know, being held together by a couple more, you know, strings than we were thinking. But it's one of those where I can picture being disappointed in the context of, you know, wanting to be in the playoffs, or at least in the discussion in weeks 9 and 10. But if we're still at 7 wins, I know that Brett Bielema is going to keep getting bites at the apple and that this is going to be a program that continues to ascend.
Yeah. I mean, hard to argue with that. I kind of came in here thinking, you know, 8-4 was the number I was looking at, but Brett Bielema has just surpassed expectations every step of the way. And like, he's done nothing for me to doubt that he can't get the most out of this team. I mean, the only things I've ever questioned with Brett Bielema were a couple, you know, punt versus go for it decisions in his first season. But aside from that, I mean, he's been unbelievable. And, you know, I think he's the real deal. I'm going to join you at the 9-3 mark, but it honestly wouldn't surprise me. Like, I think there's a better chance that we go 11-1 than we go, you know, 6-6 this year.
Yep. Yep.
So like, to me, I think 9-3 is a good number to trust. Now, if we end up 7-5, I'm not necessarily disappointed. Like you said, maybe 6-6 where I start. Yeah. It's hard to be disappointed if you go to a bowl game, given the historical context of being an Illinois fan and what we've seen this program, you know, be over the years. But like, I do think that the Brett Bielema factor is a real deal. His attention to detail is unbelievable. He has these guys all, you know, on the same page, believing he's got the right pieces. He's got the seniors. He's got two coordinators back. He's going to try to build on last season. And I know, you know, the analytics tell us last year's team wasn't a 10-3 team. We were a 8-5 team or whatever it was. But to me, like, this is a better team. I think we'll see, you know, a hopefully better, even better product on the field. But you never know when you play teams like Ohio State and USC and, you know, a team like Indiana after their season last year. Maybe they are, maybe Cignetti is the guy in Bloomington and that team's a wagon, you know, just as good, if not better than our program. So it's really hard to say until we get a few weeks in to see what these teams are starting to look like given our schedule. But man, I think the way our Big Ten schedule sets up, the back half, we should go on a nice run. It's just a matter of, can we get through those first seven games before the bye week with a, you know, a 5-win total and, you know, potentially get ourselves a game day, whether it's the USC game or the Ohio State game, if we're, you know, putting up some good results early on. I think game day will, I know SEC ESPN is always favoring the South when it comes to where they want to go. But knowing that Champaign hasn't hosted a game day, I could see us potentially getting our chance in the bright lights. And we know last year after the Michigan game and all the fanfare around that, like, Brett Bielema plus a full Memorial Stadium for almost every game this year, there's just going to be a buzz and energy around the team that we haven't seen. And I think we can, you know, hopefully carry some of the momentum with us rather than letting that distract us. I don't think Bielema is going to let that happen.
I also love that you brought back the second order win totals, because that's something that I wanted to touch on in terms of, maybe, you know, we've talked positively of how some people are viewing, you know, the polls have us number 12 and some people are thinking that we can compete for a college football playoff spot. There are a lot of people out there, especially, you know, those folks who are more in the gambling spheres, that see this as like kind of an overvalued Illinois team. They're not really buying the Brett Bielema hype. And what they'll tell you is that this, like you said, this was an 8-win team that won 10 games. And the argument for that is not necessarily a bad one, that progression isn't linear in football. It isn't linear in anything in life, obviously. But the expectation of just, oh yeah, they keep ascending and then 8 wins turns into 9 wins or 10 wins, you know, year over year with the same players. Yeah, you could point to losing Zakari and Pat, and you could point to the fact that progression isn't linear. But you're also then you're not taking into account the fact that this is such a senior-laden team, such an experience-laden team, and that, yeah, your progression from a guy like a Colin Dixon or a Malik Elzey is going to be a bit more spotty, maybe more up and down. But you're not relying on those kind of guys to be the program drivers for the season. You're relying on guys who have been in the program for 3, 4, 5 years, some of them, and that's something that's going to carry through the ability to dig deep and get those wins that ascends you to 9-10 wins in a season. That even if you are 5-1 in one score games, maybe you're not in as many one score games, or maybe you're in 10 one score games and it doesn't even matter because you have all those guys with all that experience, with all those banked reps that know exactly what they need to be doing because they're coached by Brett Bielema, and they go out there and they go 10-0 in those one score games. I don't understand this thought of, okay, well, yeah, you have there. I'm not going to, once again, diminishing Pat Zakari is something I will not do. That is something that it will probably lead to a couple of losses because of the fact that they carried us in a multitude of ways, not disputing that. But to say that those two were the huge factors of last season, the only thing that we had going for us, is just, it makes me want to grab people by their shirts and mess them up and beat the crap out of them. Because it's like, what are you talking about? You clearly don't understand football. You also don't understand Brett Bielema teams. The whole one score thing is so insane to me because of the fact that that's like how they play football. It keeps you in those games against USC. It keeps you in those games against Ohio State. It'll keep you in a game, yes, maybe against a tomato can that you should be beating, but it's not going to be quite like the prior eras of coaches where, oh, you're down, you know, 2 scores to a Western Michigan, or you're down, you know, 3 scores to a Toledo. Like, this is just, it's not going to happen. Yeah, maybe you're down 10 points. Maybe you're down 4 points going to half, maybe even in the third quarter. Maybe you need a Miles Scott interception to kind of bail you out, or you need something to happen, you know, where you kind of get a fluke play. But that's just the way Brett Bielema coaches his teams. And I just don't understand how people don't understand that when they're looking at it and applying it to their projections and saying, oh yeah, this is an 8-win team that was lucky to win 10 games. And they're probably going to be an 8-win team again. Plus, we can't rely on a couple things here and there, and they're, you know, super dependent upon some seniors. It's like, no, that's not how this works, at least from our, you know, very specific vantage point. But I think that informs us in a great way, that we know that we're going to be able to be in those games and pull out wins more often than not. So that's where I would just say that that's like when talking about second order wins from last year and trying to apply some kind of mathematical equation with returning production, but then people lost and how this all formats with the schedule. Just know that, yes, we will probably be in a close game. Understood. We'll probably win that because Brett Bielema is our coach and he is going to have those guys ready to win that game.
Yeah, I mean, I love that point. Like, Brett Bielema is the boa constrictor that just, he gets his body wrapped around you, gets his team wrapped around you, and he just tries to choke you out like a UFC fighter. Just gets on your back, gets his little arm under your chin, and just tightens the grip, tightens and tightens and tightens until you tap out. And, you know, it's not going to be the flashiest, you know, Indiana, we're going to beat you 77-0 every game. It's, you know, it's a more calculated, probably risk-averse style of play, and it's not flashy, but it's effective, and, you know, he proved it last year, and like you said, yeah, everyone points to the 5-1 and one-score game stat, and it's like, you know, Brett Bielema's lucking into these wins. Like, no, that's a choice more often than not. Yeah, there were lucky moments, and there were, balls that bounced our way at certain times last year. It's not all, you know, by design necessarily, but like, there's a reason Brett Bielema wins those close games more often than not historically, like beyond last season. And like you said, there's even more continuity coming back. Yes, you lose a couple wide receivers, but you ask any coach in the country if he wants to return 16 of 22 starters and thinks he's going to get a better result on the field, 100% of the time they're going to take that. So 9-3, both you and I think we're on the same page, you know. If it ends up being 7-5, we're not disappointed, but this team just as easily could be an 11-win team that's dancing come playoff time. So hopefully that's the result we see.
I also love that we get the quote unquote harder games at home, like getting with a good team. Sometimes it would be like, oh yeah, I'd rather have like some of those coin flip games at home in the past, you know, instead of taking a shellacking against Ohio State or Michigan or Oregon in years past. I know that hasn't been the case, but like say teams like that historically, even though we get the quote unquote home field advantage, we're not going to make as much use of it as if we got, you know, a Minnesota or an Iowa or Wisconsin at home. And, you know, we're playing that game away in a given year. It's like, at this point, I'm almost at the inverse where I'm okay playing Duke and Indiana away. I know that, yeah, it might not be 2-0 in those games, but I would rather have it break that way. And then having a USC come to Champaign or an Ohio State come to Champaign, where you were saying, yeah, almost every game is going to be sold out. It's going to be packed to the gills. You're going to have that momentum that is going to be able to be felt and heard and seen and applied by the players, so that those games that, yeah, maybe historically aren't necessarily toss-ups become more of a toss-up. And then you get in a one-score game, and then you have some Brett Bielema magic happen, and then you win those games. Whereas I would not feel the same way about going to Los Angeles or going to Columbus this year. So getting those games and having them be able to be winnable at home, I love it.
Do you want to hear my personal schedule gripe?
Yes.
So when the schedule came out, I was partially devastated, only because all the games I want to go to, I am unable to attend. I think Western Michigan is the only game I can go to, which I'm planning on going to that. But USC, got a wedding. Ohio State, got a wedding. Rutgers, got a wedding. And then I have a delayed
honeymoon. How many wives do you have, Dan?
Yeah, too many. But November 8th, I specifically looked at the schedule prior to scheduling my my delayed honeymoon. Don't tell my wife this, but knowing that was one of our bye weeks. So it's one week we'll all be away where there won't be a game. So I don't have to worry about that. And then, you know, I'll still be gone for the November 15th Maryland game. So literally every game except for the two non-con Western Illinois, Western Michigan games, I cannot go to. So it's the one gripe I have with the schedule. Everyone else will have to cheer loud because I won't be able to be there. But I certainly will be, you know, phone out at all times where in a discreet manner where I can be to be tuned in for these games. So I guess I'll catch you guys at the Big Ten Championship game December 6th.
Yeah, or maybe Northwestern, bringing it back.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe a road trip or something. Indiana, go road trip to that game. We'll see. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll figure something out.
Also, yeah, there's no way Morgan listens to this, but if she does, hi, Morgan.
She's definitely not listening to this.
No, no shot.
But it's about the first season I can ever claim that my Illini might have loftier preseason expectations than her Alabama Crimson Tide. So we got that going for us.
Man, that would have been the ultimate matchup last year. That, I mean, I guess all's well that ends well in terms of the T-bar and the electricity of that South Carolina game. But man, it would have been fun to have matched up with Alabama.
Sad for
solely
us.
For your, yeah, solely for your personal war against the wife.
It would have been too good to be true. But
maybe this year.
Yeah. All right. Do we want to touch on Western Illinois tomorrow's matchup? It's not too much to say. We talked through the Illinois team. I mean, Western Illinois is a bad football team. Like we said, they got beat 77-3 last year. They're going to spread you out. They're going to try to go up tempo. But other than that, like, I'm hopeful that second half we'll be seeing a lot of guys farther down the depth chart than that are getting some early reps in the season.
Agreed. I'm not going to belabor any points on that. I'll give you deference because I feel like usually I get the first pick of the week. So I'll give that to you in terms of who your X factor is.
All right. My X factor. It's going to be the man who's playing the most reps at the most important position in this game, and that's Ethan Hampton, QB2, who will be the biggest factor in this game after Luke Altmyer cleans up three touchdowns and hands the ball off for a few others in the first half. I think we'll see quite a bit of Ethan Hampton. So I think he'll end the game with potentially more passes thrown than our starting quarterback. So that's why I'm going to go with Ethan Hampton as my pick of the week.
I love it. Honestly, I thought the same exact thing. I was like, maybe I go with Malik Elzey because he'll get to rack up like 100 yards and mop up duty. But I think the person I thought you were going to go with, because I think he's going to not only have a productive day catching the ball, but he's going to break the streak, Dan. He's going to do the thing. It's Hank Beatty. He's my guy. He's going to have a punt return for 50 some odd yards for a touchdown. He's going to do a couple fun jukes and just beat everyone. He's not, I think the beautiful thing with that is he has a little bit of tape from the South Carolina game. I know it was a reception. It wasn't a punt return, but him getting hawked at the 1 yard line where, that ended up turning into that completely atrocious fumble call. That should have never happened and should have been an even easier win, but I digress. But him getting hawked like that is something that, he can put his bulletin board material and motivate him to make sure that doesn't happen against Big Ten competition. And then he's just skirting around all the little dudes at Western Illinois and easily walking in the end zone. So that's my pick of the week.
So I see you're coming for my territory with a return touchdown so that you can also claim it when it happens that
yep,
we both
uh-huh.
willed
well,
into
Hank
existence.
Baby's my guy, so.
That's true.
I'll claim partial ownership, not a majority stake, but you at least gotta give me my golden parachute when we get bought out.
If Hank Beatty returns one for a touchdown, I think the field pass is the player of the week.
Yeah, exactly. We get the game ball, coach.
Do you even want to give a score prediction? Might as well, right?
Nope.
45-point favorites, and I think the over-under is 63.5. Friday night, 6:30 p.m., Peacock. Big bright lights, Western Illinois, the Leathernecks.
The thing, again, where we don't give up a touchdown for, the first however many home games it is. So let's go 60-6.
Oh.
Good guys.
Those are two field goals, or is that a late touchdown?
Two field goals.
Failed
yep.
2-point. Okay.
No, it's going to be. They'll get like a respectable field goal early in the game, and then they're just not. It'll be like a late third quarter. Just like, all right, we're going to kick the field goal here because it's already 45-3, something like that.
Yeah. I'm going to go 59-0. Let's just skunk them.
What a random 59. How do we get to 59? That's such a, what do we get to 56?
56 with a field goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe a defensive touchdowns in there and a few offense. Like I don't think we're going to put up the 77 that Indiana put up just because I think Bielema once they're up to a certain number is just comfortable running the ball and running the clock out. But like Western Illinois is going to play up tempo and they're going to throw the ball a lot. And I think that'll stop the clock early in the game and give us, several possessions enough for us to put up quite a few points. And you know, I think I think our defense just doesn't allow much. Maybe there is the early season first game miscommunication where someone blows an assignment and Western Illinois has a deep touchdown or something, but I don't foresee this one being close really at all at any point. So I'm going 59-0.
All right. I love it.
It is on Peacock. I do want to take a few minutes out of my day to complain about YouTube TV, who is apparently in negotiations with Fox Network. And I will just say that as a YouTube TV, fan and supporter over the years, if they can't get this Fox deal figured out, I don't want my $10 back per month. Figure it out. I can't have 30 streaming services for every game on every channel. Like, we need to just figure out how to keep networks on this one platform. Like, because otherwise we're doing the exact thing that happened. We had all these different channels. Someone came up with a brilliant idea. Cable TV. We're going to package everything together. Now everything's decoupling, and you better figure out your Fox deal, because it doesn't matter this week, but by week three against Western Michigan, if I can't watch that game on FS1 on YouTube TV, I am going to have a fit.
You heard it here first, folks. Those are big time threats. I don't know what we're going to do, but we'll protest in some fashion. Well, the field pass will go live from Fox headquarters and do something crazy.
Well, I guess that might wrap up the Illini 2025 football season preview from the field pass. Western Illinois tomorrow, 6:30 p.m. Peacock, the John and Dan annual Eat Your Hat Memorial game. If we don't get the job done, we'll be dining and dashing in Champaign, Illinois, feasting. What kind of hat would you eat, John?
Oh, a fresh hat from game day. We'll just go in, grab ourselves a nice block eye, a blue hat with the orange block eye, just split that right down the middle, little mesh on the back. That's what we're going with first, and then take the bill in the middle.
I feel like the block eye hat's probably a little bit tastier than maybe like the Illini victory shield, or like maybe an old beaten down chief hat.
Yep. Yep. You gotta really savor the flavor.
All right. Well, we'll be here all season long previewing, recapping games. Should be, an unbelievable season. Hopefully a lot to look forward to. Your number 12 Fighting Illini football team. Words that have never been uttered as long as I can remember. So
we're doing the thing. Also, we might be doing a little video content as well, in terms of making things a bit easier for you guys to consume on the YouTubes or the however you like to obtain your video content.
Yeah, let us know if you guys want to see some video podcasts. We'd obviously still try to publish everything in audio form as well, but I feel like I enjoy seeing video podcast content at times, and maybe it's time 6 years in we switch things up a little bit. So keep your eye out potentially for that. Let us know if you're on board. But welcome everyone that's on the bandwagon this year. Hopefully last year was a good gateway to get some more fans in the door. Obviously the numbers in Memorial Stadium looking like there's going to be an uptick, and plenty of fun games ahead to look forward to. So we appreciate you as always for tuning in. Thanks, and go Illini.